From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. The names Joseph Mengele and Rudolf Hess conjure up images of the hateful Nazi regime and the Holocaust. It's hard to imagine that they and other leaders of the Third Reich had families, but they did. And now their children are speaking out. Coming up, a talk with journalist Gerald Posner and Carl Sauer, whose father was part of Hitler's inner circle. Also, we get a rare inside look at the life and work of filmmaker Woody Allen from writer Eric Lax. He's written a new biography of the director. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Eating, the new comedy by Henry Jaglom. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Police in South Africa are investigating a series of bomb incidents in Johannesburg. Six people were injured when one bomb went off in a downtown shopping center, and two bombs were defused outside the city's main police station and a bank. Yesterday, seven people were injured in a bombing at a restaurant. There's been no claim of responsibility for any of the attacks. The bombings have taken place in predominantly white areas of the city. The federal leadership of Yugoslavia has once again failed to elect a new president, but the Croatian Stipe Mesic considers himself Yugoslavia's new chief of state. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Zagreb.
It was Croatia's turn for the post of chief of the federal presidency, which rotates annually among the country's six republics. But Marxist Serbia, which opposes non-communist Croatia's moves toward independence from the federation, once again blocked Stipe Mesic in a second ballot today. Serbia could count on the votes of its two provinces and the allied republic Montenegro to make it a 4-4 vote. At a press conference in Zagreb this evening, Stipe Mesic appeared calm and said he considers himself the president of Yugoslavia and supreme commander of the army in accordance with the federal constitution. He said Serbia tried to subvert the constitution through trickery but failed, and he announced he would convene the collective presidency when necessary. But the latest development cannot but widen ideological and ethnic conflicts between Croatia and Serbia. This is Silvia Poggioli in Zagreb.
A hospital in Chicago now faces a second lawsuit for possibly infecting hospital visitors with the virus that causes AIDS. Hospital officials are calling the two incidents, the latest that occurred this week, medical nightmares. Cheryl Corley of member station WBEZ reports.
Illinois Masonic Medical Center shut down one of its outpatient clinics and is reviewing disposal procedures there. Earlier this week, two small children in an examining room with the mother of one of them allegedly pulled a used syringe from a special medical waste container and pricked themselves with it. Tests for the HIV virus on fluid found in the syringe proved inconclusive. The children were treated with AZT, the anti-AIDS drug. They were also immunized against hepatitis. Last month, the clinic was the scene of another incident where a woman was given a routine exam with cotton swabs that had previously been used on a patient infected with the HIV virus. She, too, was treated with AZT. But hospital officials admit it will be months, maybe years, before the children or the women know whether they've been infected with AIDS. For National Public Radio, I'm Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 7 points today to close at 2,886.63. Declines edged advances in active trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 174 million shares. This is NPR News. The Pentagon said today that Defense Secretary Dick Cheney has ordered 3,700 fresh U.S. troops to Kuwait. The new troops will replace American units that are being relieved after service in the Gulf War. Defense Secretary Cheney said the replacement troops will help meet the need for a continuing military presence in Kuwait until the Emirate reconstitutes its forces. The troops are to be deployed from a base in Germany. They're expected to remain in Kuwait until the 1st of September. Cheney's statement stressed that the administration is still committed to getting U.S. ground forces out of the region as quickly as possible. The United States has given the green light to the U.S., Britain, Japan, and Switzerland to comply with an Iraqi request to unfreeze $1 billion of Iraq's assets. Linda Fasulo reports from the U.N.
The chairman of the Sanctions Committee has sent letters to the four countries letting them know they are free if they choose to release the assets to Iraq for the purchase of food, medicine, and certain approved civilian items. but the UN in no way requires them to do so. And the letter reminds the countries they are not permitted to unfreeze assets for any other purpose. But an American diplomat says it's not likely that any of the countries will comply with Iraq's request to release the $1 billion in assets at this point. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The State Department acknowledged today that about 350 Libyan guerrillas are being resettled in the United States at government expense. The guerrillas were trained by the United States to fight Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said that the Libyans were originally part of Gaddafi's army that invaded Chad. Boucher said they were among a group of prisoners of war who decided to fight the Gaddafi regime. Boucher said the Libyans were flown to New York yesterday, then moved on to undisclosed locations. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. 5 years ago, Gerald Posner published a biography about the Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele. While working on the book, Posner met with Mengele's son Rolf and was struck by the force of Rolf Mengele's complex feelings towards his father, which ranged from condemnation to loyalty. Posner realized that he had read a lot about the experiences of the children of Holocaust survivors, but it seemed that the lives of the children of the perpetrators, the Nazis, had not been explored. Though it took many years to track down the children of the leaders of the Third Reich to convince them to talk, Gerald Posner has now completed his new book, Hitler's Children. He interviewed 12 children of high-ranking Nazi officials, including Etta Goring, Wolf Hess, Rolf Mengele, and Carl Sauer Jr. Carl Sauer Jr. and Gerald Posner are my guests today. Carl Sauer Sr. was chief of the technical department in Albert Speer's armaments ministry. He was such a close confidant to Hitler that he was named in Hitler's will. After the war, Sauer was never charged with crimes and continued to live with his family. Though Carl Sauer Jr. and his brother Klaus agreed to talk for Gerald Posner's book, many of the others refused.
Not only was it difficult to find the children in the first place, but of the 40 names that I eventually came down to, only 12 agreed to speak. And it was difficult even at that point to get them to talk about their innermost feelings. It's just not something, I think, that if I can make a broad generalization, it's not something that is very German in that way. I mean, we're accustomed to turning on the television in the States and hearing people talk about the children of famous people, talk about what it was like to grow up in the household. But it's hard for a German to talk about his innermost and personal feelings to his father, especially if that father was a Nazi official.
You talked about 12 people talking to you. How did you convince them? What did you say to them, you think, that made them want to talk about this part of their past?
I think that what eventually convinced them is the fact that I was going to print, and I did print in the book, exactly what they had to say. This was an opportunity for them to say whether they defended their fathers and thought he was a wonderful person, or whether they condemned their fathers and politically thought he was reprehensible, to say it and get their viewpoint across. There was a lot of suspicion when I first approached some of them, because they've been approached before sometimes by German journalists who knew where they lived, and reports had been done about their parents that they considered quite scandalous or tabloid, and they were very suspicious that anybody was really going to come forward and give them the opportunity to say their piece. But that's what I was interested in. I would sometimes have a child say to me, I love my parent. I think he was a wonderful person. The Third Reich wasn't terrible, but I don't want to tell you that for publication. I would say, well, that's exactly what I'm interested in hearing. Please sit down and talk to me. Sometimes they would, sometimes they would not.
Gerald Posner, you write about meeting Mengele's son, Rolf, who talked about really being tormented by his father's past and yet feeling protective of him at the same time. This conflict, this conflict between shame, I guess, and love, did you find this typical of these children?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, Mengele's case is unusual only in the sense that he's the only one of the 12 children that I spoke to that actually was confronted with the choice of turning his father in. His father was a fugitive. He knew where he was. He believed his father was guilty of all the crimes, but still, as you said, could not bring himself to turn his father into authorities. Others had the same conflict. Norman Frank, who absolutely is torn by the image of a good and loving father and that of a criminal, said that if his father was alive and was hiding away from authorities, he still could not turn him in, notwithstanding that he thinks he's guilty of horrible crimes. And 11 of the 12 children, even those that condemned their parents, said that if their parents, in fact, had been wanted by authorities, they would never be the ones to actually provide them to the authorities. So there was some loyalty bond that holds, even in the cases where children condemn their fathers.
Carl Sauer, what kind of father was your father?
I think there's a little bit difference. We had experience later when I had to learn to know my father. I was 5 years old after the war. He was very dominating at home, just like a little dictator at home. But I think one point to mention that most of the men described in this book had not the feeling to be guilty what they are doing on the day and changing their behavior on the night. Most of them switched in this behavior as a normal duty. They were not criminals in a sense we thought of criminals. They thought it's necessary to eliminate the Jews. That's a problem. I think it's a much bigger problem than to be only a criminal, a normal criminal. And so it's to see that the family situation didn't change. There were not two persons, two different persons, one good at night and one bad at day. It's just the same person. They thought they are working out their duty and they are just in the same kind, the family fathers at home.
Were these people then psychopaths?
Yes, I think that Goering was definitely a psychopath and that some of them were, but I don't think that all of them, certainly in this book, the fathers were psychopaths. And in the case of Carl Zauer's father, I don't think of him as a psychopath. I think of him as a very opportunistic man. I think of that if Hitler had in fact said it's Greeks who are bad or it's Turks who are bad, he would have been anti-Greek or anti-Turk. But Hitler said it's Jews who are bad, and therefore he was anti-Semitic. He really is the bureaucrat who is very efficient at his job, who decides to mimic and echo all of the beliefs of National Socialism, maybe not so much as an ideologue, but because he is enamored with Hitler and believes that's the best way to advance.
Was his then attraction to National Socialism just that it was as he saw it then, a solution to Germany's economic problems, or did he also have an attraction to Hitler, the man?
Both. In the beginning, I think it was just an attraction to a way of leadership, of government, to encourage technical developments, not to discuss it in democratic parliaments, but to decide, to develop, to go forward. When he met Hitler, suddenly it changed to the person of Hitler. Until his death in 1966, he ever mentioned that there was no greater man in history for him than Hitler, and it was a great luck to meet him, to be so close to him, to discuss such a lot of matters with him, and he never doubted it in any way.
Do you think if given the opportunity and if he had had a different kind of job within the Third Reich that he personally would have exterminated Jews?
You know, it's one of the most difficult questions. It's really difficult. I think I'm not speaking now about my father. I'm speaking about anybody. It's very difficult to judge where is the edge, what everybody is doing. I think history learned us that a lot of people entered the edge, went beyond the edge, and did it. You know, 6 million people were executed in Germany. It's impossible that this was done by one man. There must be a machinery of people to do it. And so I fear, he would have done it too, but it's really difficult to judge it on one person.
Carl Sauer and Gerald Posner are my guests. Carl Sauer's father, also named Carl, was a trusted confidant of Adolf Hitler. He was deputy chief of the armaments ministry from 1942 until 1945. And Carl Sauer, the son, is featured in Gerald Posner's book called Hitler's Children. And Gerald Posner interviewed the children of prominent members of Adolf Hitler's inner circle, and their stories are in his book called Hitler's Children. Gerald Posner, I'm listening to Carl Sauer talk about his father and some of the conflicts as the son of this man, the conflicts that he's had to deal with. Is this, not that every story is going to be typical, but do you hear other children that you interviewed also wrestling with some of the horrible contradictions in their parents' lives.
Absolutely. No question. For instance, Norman Frank, the eldest son of Hans Frank, says that he's never had children because he doesn't think the Frank name should go on. He is so conflicted by this problem. In his mind is the image, he said, of the good and loving father and that of the criminal. There is a daughter in the book. Her father is still alive, Dagmar Drexel. She actually discovered after the war her father's crimes. He had been indicted. He never told her about what. He said it had something to do with the war, but he couldn't remember anything. And she had a very, very close relationship to him. She discovered in 1974 a copy of the indictment in his briefcase and saw that every time there was a charge and it would say on this day four Jews were taken to the pit and shot and thrown in, he had scratched out and put no, it was eight because on this day I was doing this in the morning. And it stunned her. He had incredible recall. He remembered everything. He admitted his guilt. And she says that he's still alive. She can't talk to him. She doesn't let him near her own children. She cannot understand how this man, who was so wonderful to her, was also capable of this. Your question also a moment ago to Karl Zauer about whether his father would have actually been involved in the extermination of the Jews is a question that I think haunts many of the children whose fathers were not directly involved in the extermination. They wonder if in fact their fathers had that opportunity, would they have gotten blood directly on their hands? And the saving grace for some of them is they answer it differently than Karl Zauer. They say, no, I think that if my father had been presented with that opportunity, he would have said no. Of course, it's speculation, but that's always their hope. The worst situation is to be the child of somebody involved directly in the concentration camps.
What's then the difference between these children, between those who defend their fathers and those who criticize their fathers?
I find the difference quite drastic. The children who criticize their fathers from a political viewpoint or a personal viewpoint are the ones who have had much more thinking about this. They've come to grips with this in a very, very different way. They take this as an obligation and a responsibility, the fact that their fathers were involved in the Third Reich, which hurt so many people and was involved in so many crimes. They wonder about how they will talk to their own children, what the obligation and responsibility is that they have to carry out in their own lives as a result of their father's duties. And I respect their position. In the case of the children who defend their parents, I find that there's a great deal of denial. They block out much of the history and what really happened. Wolf Hesus is probably the strongest proponent for defending his father and being proud of his father, really refuses to look at any of the historical facts that really describe the Third Reich and its crimes. Instead, he blocks all of it out. And I think in doing that, in having that type of denial, he actually carries this burden on for another generation. He doesn't allow his own children to become free of it. Instead, they really hear it only from him. They must now carry on this defense of their grandfather, and yet still they haven't been able to shake loose of it as well.
Karl Zauer, how much of the war intruded in your young life as a child growing up in Germany?
The first years after the war, we lived with my mother and the sister of my mother, five children, and we were very poor at this time after being very wealthy in the war time, of course. And there was a rumor, not spoken about, but it was a rumor. It's something untrusted to us. So I heard something a little bit about my father was a great man at the war time, and now we have to carry the burden of this. But it was never really discussed. When I was 12 years old, when I heard for the first time in school about the crimes in the concentration camps to the Jews.
That was the first time you'd ever heard those stories?
Yeah, it was in 56, 11 years after the war. It was never mentioned at home before, and it was never mentioned anywhere else before. So I was very astonished. I was, as mentioned, 12 years old. So I was very confused to hear about that. Until this time, I remember exactly, I thought there was something great, there was something happened in the wartime, and your father was involved in this in a high-ranking position, but I never knew until this time it was really bad. I was the feeling we are told it was bad, but there was no reason to believe it.
I'm speaking today with Karl Zauer and Gerald Posner. Gerald Posner has written a book called Hitler's Children, and he's interviewed the children of prominent members of Adolf Hitler's inner circle. Karl Sauer's father, also named Karl, was a trusted confidant of Adolf Hitler. He was also deputy chief of the armaments ministry from 1942 until 1945. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Karl Sauer and Gerald Posner are my guest. Karl Sauer, your father cooperated with the Allies after the war. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Not with the Allies, but with Americans, I would say.
Okay, with the Americans.
Yeah.
Why did he do that? Is this again his pragmatism?
I think so. Pragmatism, it's a more positive word. I would say it's opportunism, as Mr. Posner told it before. I think... as he was opportunistic in his political or in his technical career in the Third Reich, besides his relationship to Hitler, I think he was opportunistic in cooperation with American. And I think his dream was to go to America one day and to rebuild something like that here, armament industry or something similar. And I think one of his greatest disappointments in life was that this never happened.
Can you imagine if indeed you had had the kind of father that you could have talked to about his life? Can you imagine the kind of conversation you might have had with him and what you would have asked him and perhaps even told him as a young boy or a teenage boy?
Difficult question. I hope so, but I'm not sure. I think my fault was that I never discussed it strong and serious with him until his death in 66. I was 22 at this time, and I regretted it very often afterwards.
You regretted the conversation?
Yeah. Not to speak with him in a real confrontal way.
Okay.
But nevertheless, I am not sure whether I would be able to do it really when I was 25 or 30 years. It's really hard to discuss it with one you know very well. You like him in the one or other way, and to confront him with his past when you see he is unable to do it by himself.
Could you do it now, if he were still alive?
I don't know. I hope so.
Gerald Posner, were there children that did confront their parents?
Only in two instances. I was very surprised that even in other instances when parents survived after the war, for the most part, the children were not able to sit down and discuss the Third Reich, their father's involvement, and why they were not strong enough to have made a break with the Third Reich. The instances in which it did come up was, in Mengele's case, his son at the age of 33 traveled to South America to see his father in Brazil at the time and confronted him over Auschwitz in 2 weeks of real raucous arguments at night. What he wanted to hear from his father, he told me, was, I was at Auschwitz and the things are true that happened there. However, I hated it. I tried to get a transfer, but it was my orders. He said that would have been enough to at least made me think that my father had some humanity in him. Instead, his father told him, don't question me about it. You'll never understand. We were doing the right thing and this is the end of the discussion. The other person who confronted their father is a daughter whose father is still alive. Her father was never convicted or charged with crimes, but he was a committed Nazi and early party member, Ingeborg Scheer. And she says that she's confronted her father in arguments for over 20 years about what happened to the Jews. And the best she can get her father to say today, he lives in Austria, is that maybe the extermination of the Jews was wrong. She said, after 20 years of confrontation and arguments, all I can get him to say is maybe. He can't even say, at the time I thought it was right, and now I know it was wrong.
Why has she continued this argument for 20 years? Why is it so important to her?
It is very important to her, she said, because she believes that if her father could express this fact that he now realizes that National Socialism was wrong, it would free both of them. She loves her father. She talks to him constantly. She tries to have a regular relationship relationship with him. However, she also married a Jewish man, and she thinks that this was part of the rebellion that she had to teach her father that he had to be open-minded. Her father was absolutely catatonic at the time. He just could not believe that his daughter would actually marry somebody who was Jewish. One of the pieces of advice that her mother gave her at the time is don't have any children from them. You know they make such bad offspring, this mixed type of marriage. But he has actually allowed his son-in-law to come over to his house at times. The daughter believes that she's seen some cracks open up in her father, but literally he's now 81 years old. That this is somebody at the end of his life, and basically he holds on to the old days and the old theories.
Carl Sauer, do you feel responsible for what your father did?
I think responsible, it's not the right expression. I think we have the obligation to talk about this as we do it here now. We have to confront ourselves with these things. And as a son of a leading Nazi party member or state member at this time, I think I have the obligation to confront myself and German society with the things.
I'm wondering, with the reunification of Germany, whether that gives you cause for concern that it might become fertile ground for fascism, only because there are some economic uncertainties. There are many uncertainties, I guess, associated with the reunification. I'd like to put that question to both of you. Carl Sauer?
Yeah. At the moment, I think we have in Germany the problem really with reunification in much more ways. For example, there is a right wing in this GDR population, in this old GDR population, under pressed for 40 years there. It's coming now out. There are skinheads in the east of Germany. We thought there will never be something like that. So you have to see, it changed a little bit, but in general, I think there is no danger at the moment in Germany for raising a new fascism, not more, even less than in other European countries or in countries around the world. But nevertheless, we have the obligation to watch it very carefully and to do anything against this and to stabilize democracy, the efforts for democracy in Germany.
Gerald Posner?
I think that there's always the possibility, as Carl Sauer just said, that fascism could pop up its ugly head in any troubled time in the European countries, in Central Europe and in Eastern Europe. However, I think that there's less of a chance of it today in Germany than at any time since World War II. Germany acknowledges, in large part, although there are certainly segments of anti-Semitism and there are people that want to revise history and say the Holocaust never happened, for the most part, the government of Germany and most of its people recognize these crimes took place, that there is a special obligation to this country, and they have tried to deal with it through restitution and other means, and they do discuss it in the media and in print. However, I've traveled, you know, extensively through Eastern Europe and other countries. In Austria, they don't even acknowledge their responsibility for these crimes, although they staffed the concentration camps in undue proportions. They say we were victims. In Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, I was shocked by the amount of anti-Semitism I saw recently, the possibility for fascism in the Serbian-Croatian split. So I think that there are other areas in Europe that have real concern, even more than Germany.
My thanks to both of you, Carl Sauer and Gerald Posner, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Carl Sauer's father was a member of Adolf Hitler's Third Reich and part of Hitler's inner circle. Gerald Posner interviewed Carl Sauer and 11 other children whose fathers were leaders under Hitler's regime for his book called Hitler's Children. I'm Marty Moskow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. When journalist Eric Lax first interviewed Woody Allen in 1971 during the filming of Bananas, it was hard for him to get anything but a yes or no answer from the young director. But Lax eventually gained his trust, and now 20 years later, he's written Allen's biography. Coming up, we examine the life and career of Woody Allen with Eric Lax. And film director Henry Jaglom has a new comedy about women and food called Eating. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Pentagon has announced that 3,700 U.S. troops will be moved from Germany to Kuwait for the summer. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney says that there has been agreement to keep forces in Kuwait until September as a temporary measure. A British engineer held in Iraq since September has been found guilty of spying and sentenced to life in prison. Jonathan Dyer reports from London.
A Foreign Office spokesman said that a life sentence could mean 20 years imprisonment, although he could not confirm it as Britain has ceased diplomatic relations with Iraq and communications are carried out by the Soviets. The 51-year-old engineer, Douglas Brand, was arrested last September while working for a company on contract to clear mines from the Shatt al-Arab waterway between Iraq and Iran. There was a fear that he might receive the death penalty, but speaking after the sentence was passed, Rosemary Brand remained optimistic for her husband's release.
It is a blow, but I really do hope that there is still a chance of Dougie coming home.
Britain's ambassador to the United Nations has described Iraq's treatment of Mr. Brand as a contravention of the UN ceasefire resolutions. For National Public Radio, I'm Jonathan Dyer in London.
Officials say that a mystery disease has killed more than 20 children returning from Iraqi refugee camps on the Turkish border. Medical workers say the victims, most of them under the age of 3, appear to be dying from a blood infection, but doctors don't know what type or how the children got it. And there have been new warnings about pollution caused by the hundreds of oil wells burning in Kuwait, this time from an expert on the environment. Alex Kirby filed this report for the BBC.
Professor Boshkoff is especially concerned at the quantity of sulfur dioxide being given off by the smoke from the wells. He says it's at least as much as the combined emissions from Britain, France, Germany and Italy. Sulfur dioxide is one of the main causes of acid rain, and Professor Boshkoff says the rain falling in Iran is more acid than anything known in Central or Eastern Europe. It's likely to cause crop damage within a radius of 2,000 kilometres. Soot from the wells is also falling to earth as grey snow, and Professor Boshkoff says this may hasten the rate at which glaciers and snowfields melt in the mountains, threatening people downstream with the possibility of flooding. There have been suggestions that the smoke and soot from the fires could alter the Asian monsoon. Professor Boshkoff thinks they will probably raise temperatures and bring more rain to the countries which rely on the monsoon. He says the effects of the fires may reach as far as the southern Soviet Union and western China.
Alex Kirby reporting for the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 7 points to close at 2,886.63 on volume of some 174 million shares. This is NPR News. President Bush says that there is good reason for optimism about the Middle Eastern peace process. Mr. Bush made his comment after getting a first-hand report from Secretary of State James Baker on his fourth trip to the Middle East, where he was unable to work out plans for a regional peace conference. The president said that quiet diplomacy is now needed to gain agreement on a conference. Baker returned home last night without any of three key Middle Eastern leaders backing his plan for a conference. Israel and Syria disagree about any role for the UN, and Jordan's King Hussein has yet to agree to attend a meeting with Israel. At least 30 hospitals across the country have received organs and tissues from a donor who unknowingly carried the AIDS virus. Joni Spangler reports that the organ transplant service that supplied the tissue is now working to help track down dozens of recipients.
Recipients of the man's heart and kidneys have died of AIDS, and a bone graft recipient has tested positive for HIV. Doug Wilson of the Virginia-based LifeNet Transplantation Service says all hospitals and patients involved have been contacted.
There were 54 tissue grafts processed by this donor. Two corneas were recovered by an eye bank. It's highly unlikely that the majority of these grafts could transmit any disease, including HIV.
Wilson says the most of the tissues were treated by freeze-drying, ethanol, or gamma irradiation, which would have killed any bacteria, disease, or virus. The donor was a 22-year-old man who died of a gunshot wound to the head during a robbery, and his organs tested negative twice before they were removed. For National Public Radio, I'm Joni Spangler in Richmond.
According to Tehran Radio, Iran has now reached agreement with Pakistan on building an oil refinery near Karachi. This facility will be able to produce some 120,000 barrels of oil every day. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Woody Allen fans, and there are many of them, like to look for a piece of themselves in his movies. Allen's comedies are anxiety-ridden, obsessive, full of self-doubts. His serious movies pose moral questions and ponder the meaning of our lives. So we think we know him. But for all his fame, Woody Allen shuns the publicity that usually goes along with it. Eric Lax is a journalist who met Allen 20 years ago and spent the last four working on Allen's biography. It's not authorized in the sense that Allen asked him to do it, but it is an admiring cooperative effort between Lax and Allen with help from Allen's associates and friends. Woody Allen is known for withholding information. Actors working on his films are only given their pages to learn, nothing else. I asked Lax if he thought Allen kept anything from him.
No, and here's why. I think that even if he wanted to, over a period of 20 years off and on, and for the last 4 years very intensively of talking, and where I've had the opportunity to interview more than 100 people who he's worked with and grown up with, where I've seen him for hours on end and interviewed him for countless hours on end, that no matter what he wanted to hide, it's pretty hard to hide that once I become privy to so much information. So that I don't think there's any way that he could dictate, you know, what I would know and what I wouldn't know.
It's interesting to me that he is a recluse, a private man in one of the world's most populous cities. I mean, it seems to me that if you want privacy, move to Wyoming. Don't live in New York City.
Ah, but if you're in New York City, you're one among so many, and in Wyoming, you're an easy target.
Is that his philosophy? I know he's smitten with New York.
But. Yes, I think his philosophy is that if you're not in New York, what's the point of being alive? That there is something about the city that captivated him from an early age. He first went to the city with his father when he was 5 or 6, and he says, you know, when I came up out of the subway and I looked around in Times Square and there was a movie theater here, and 20 feet later there was another movie theater, and there were papaya stands and guys with suitcases and apparently stringless dolls dancing on them. He says it was just a wonder to me. And he played hooky from school one day, and he went to a theater. It was the first time he'd gone to a movie in New York, and Duke Ellington and his orchestra came up out of the pit, you know, playing Take the A-Train. He says it just blew the top of my mind off. It started a love affair with the city that, you know, you see, of course, most affectionately in the film Manhattan. But in all of Woody Allen's films, New York is this glimmering, soaring place that's, you know, filled with cosmopolitan people. And he says, of course, that's not the New York that really exists. He says it's a portion of it, but New York is dirty and it's decaying and it's filled with the homeless. He said, but my feeling about it has never changed from my first impressions as a child. He says, I know it's a terrible place in many ways now. He says, but I'm like a child whose father is a bank robber or an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. You love them in spite of their failings.
Do you think he came from a traumatic or even dysfunctional family, or had a traumatic childhood?
He certainly had a traumatic childhood. His parents were simply unable to get along. They were kind of gunpowder and a match over anything. They each took the opposite side. His mother was very penurious. His father was very spendthrift. They obviously loved each other. They've been married and have been married for 60 some years now. But for Woody, it was traumatic in that he was subjected to the arguments on a constant basis. And one of the things about him now is that he just simply doesn't lose his temper. He just has an inability to do it. He says the idea of losing your temper in front of your kids would just be so awful to do.
Well, he even seems to imply that it was his parents bickering and fighting that robbed him of a temper.
Yes, I think that's the implication of there, is that I think he saw it as being destructive, and that it obviously frightened him. He said there were days that I'd go to school and not know that I would have two parents when I came home that night.
Well, instead of getting mad, what does he do?
He got even. This is the title of his first book. he learned early on that you can buy your way out of difficult situations with a laugh. He has, on top of sort of a funny gene in his elbow or his knee or wherever the funny gene is, that he just has this natural talent for humor, is that he learned that humor was really a wonderful way to make a difficult situation better. And he exploited that early in his life. He was very amusing among his friends and those close to him, although he never really spoke to strangers. So there were really two Alan Koningsbergs, as he was then known. He was not voted the most funny guy at Midwood High School because not very many people knew him. But what was amazing is that he came in second among the few people who knew him, they realized that he was this very funny kid. So that he's been able to transport that into a wide variety of successes for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Lax. He's the author of a new biography of Woody Allen. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Eric Lax is my guest, and we're talking about his new biography of Woody Allen. You have some very painful descriptions of his attempts at stand-up comedy, and this went on for a long time. The terror as he would wait in the wings to go out, and the kind of non-reaction from the audience.
Yes, you know, when he would first go on, he was just so terrified, he literally had to be pushed onto the stage sometimes. And curiously enough, that when people did respond well to him, he would put his hands over his ears to shut out the applause. And I asked him about this. I said, here's this old story about you putting your hands over your ears. I said, why would you do this? And he said, it's obviously some deep-seated psychological thing. He said, all I can suggest is that as a child, I so wanted approbation and approval. I so wanted people to love me in one way or another that once they began to applaud or to ask for my autograph, I was so embarrassed by the kind of venality of my wish that I wanted to run away from it again. But as he started out as a performer early on, he would get in, and he was performing in groups of 8 or 10 people at a time, two or three shows a night is the hardest kind of group to work. But he had to learn the timing and learn how to relate to the audience. He had, before he started to perform, a certain kind of wise guy, sort of hostile attitude. He had to abandon that once he started to perform. He realized, after his manager Jack Rollins told him about it, one night Woody was complaining after a show, he's saying, they don't get it, basically saying, they don't know what's funny. And Rollins said, you have to let them like you. You have to let them into you. He said, once they like you, they'll laugh at you. And so he had to go from being this kind of wise guy, snooty sort of fellow, to somebody who people could understand and who people could like.
He credits Danny Simon for turning his professional career around. And I guess in terms of building a joke or a funny story, how to build it on the straight line.
Yes, that was to this day, he says that there are four people he thinks are the most crucial to his career. And one of them is Danny Simon, who is Neil Simon's older brother, and who the two of them wrote together for some time, both Danny and Neil, and then later Danny and Woody. And Woody was about 19 when Simon took him under his wing and taught him that the most important thing about a joke is not the punchline, but the straight line. If you have a great straight line, then you will have a great punchline. You will have you may have what you think is the best punchline in the world, and if you have a rotten straight line going into it, the joke will just not fly as well.
His other influences include two people that I consider to be both ends of the movie spectrum, one of them Ingmar Bergman and the other one Bob Hope. Where do you see their influences?
Bob Hope, if you look at Woody Allen's movies when he's doing, especially if you look at in Sleeper, and I'll give you an example in a second, he does, from time to time, Bob Hope to a T. Bob Hope had these conversational lines that were delivered in kind of a meringue-like way. Hope was the coward's coward. He was vain. He was a womanizer. And yet, in the end, he had all this pluck and bravado that would come through. In Sleepers, there's this scene where Woody and Diane Keaton are dressed as doctors. They're from an underground movement, and they're going to kidnap what's left of the leader, the great authoritarian big brother figure who is running the world at that time. And all that's left of the leader now is his nose, from which they're going to clone a new leader. And there they are in the hospital, and they're going down the hall, and Woody has Keaton by the hand, and he's biting her fingernails, and he's saying, don't be worried, meanwhile he's shooing away on that. And then they get to the guard at the door, and Woody's kind of, fills himself up a little bit in this perfect hope way, where he just kind of puts the arm out and says, taps the guard on the chest and says, we're here to see the nose. I understand it's running.
Oh, God.
Hope did that all the time. Hope is the kind of guy who can stand around, with Arnold Palmer saying he's one of my best pupils. and Hope was, at about 7 years old, was just a gigantic influence on Woody. He was watching The Road to Morocco, and there were Hope and Crosby riding a camel and singing, like Webster's Dictionary, "We're Morocco Bound." And he saw these guys with this fantastic verbal interplay between themselves, and he said, gosh, this is what I want to be.
Now, Ingmar Bergman, I think, epitomizes the dark, brooding interior.
Right. Bergman's for the big questions. Bergman, when he was 17 or 18, he and some friends heard there was a picture with some nudity in it. The picture with the nudity, and it turned out to be Summer with Monica. And, of course, it was a must-see picture. He was 17 years old, so off they went to see it. And, the nudity was there, but he said, gee, that was nice, but the movie was really terrific. And here was a kid who was not particularly learned, did not take school at all seriously, and found something in these films that resonated in him. His argument all the time now is people accuse Woody of saying, of dwelling only on these, the big questions. Why is life worth living? Is there a God? And his argument is that whether he treats them comically or seriously, he says those are the only questions worth answering, and asking. And when people say, well, we sat up all night as college sophomores talking about this, but now we've gone on to other things, his argument would be, you've matured a lot since you were a college sophomore, and maybe it's time to start asking those questions again.
How would you describe his directing style? And actors have not necessarily complained about it, but have been puzzled by his lack of direction.
Yes, he's very subtle in the way he does it. He calls himself more a corrector than a director, but that's not entirely true. There are two huge themes of his life that came early on to him and that run through all his movies. One is music, which is he fell in love with jazz at an early age, and we'll come back to this perhaps in a second. And he scores all of his own movies. But the other thing that really matters and what reflects in his directing is the influence of magic. When he was 11 years old, he became entranced by magic and loved the notion of misdirection and sleight of hand, that you draw the attention one place and then pull off the effect somewhere else. That same misdirection is what he applies to the way he deals with actors. He wants them to come in and to be thrown off enough so that that whatever plan they have for their interpretation of what this character is, he tries to set it up so that they're kind of forced to deliver their lines conversationally, as Bob Hope did, that they come in and the spontaneity of the voice comes through. And it can be frustrating if you're an actor who's used to an entire script to come and work on a Woody Allen film, and if you only have one scene or two scenes, you'll only get the sides for the scenes that you're in. You'll never know, sort of what part of the bomb you're making.
Does he have a favorite of his own movies?
His favorite at the moment, I suspect, is Purple Rose of Cairo. It has an ending which is really the reason that he made it, which is that you have to accept reality over fantasy every time. That's what makes life run. There is a lot of his childhood in there, of the kid who went to the movies and tried to escape. It's a wonderful sort of notion, it's a story within a story of a woman is sitting in a theater and a character. She goes again and again and again to see the film, and the character in the movie suddenly looks out and says, this is the fourth time I've seen you today, and you're a very interesting-looking woman. It comes out, and the movie comes to a start because the other actors in the movie comes to a stop because the other actors can't go on without him to deliver the lines. And it's this wonderful kind of fantasy, and you think, wouldn't it be wonderful if life were like that? But yet this character comes out of the movie, and they go to a restaurant or a bar, and he tries to buy her something, and he pulls the money out of his pocket, and of course it's play money. And the currency of the movies, he's saying, is worthless in reality. And in the end, that's what we're stuck with.
I want to get back to something you said earlier. It's an image of him clapping his hands over his ears as people were applauding his stand-up comedy. Is he suspicious of success? And I'm thinking he has had some successful movies, and successful meaning popular. They made some money, and popular and critical successes. And yet that seems to put him into some kind of a tailspin when something like that happens.
In a number of ways. One, he's, you know, the reason that he doesn't take accept Oscars when he's given, or any other awards that come along, is he says, as gratifying as it could be to have them, that if you accept the verdict of people when they say you're good, that means that you have to accept the verdict of people when they say you're bad. And he says, you can only be responsible for yourself for what you believe is good and bad. One of the reasons I think that he's been able to make 20 movies of the high caliber that he's done, and will make another 20 or so, I'm sure, before he's done, is that he's never stopped to rest on success or rest on his laurels. The moment someone's come around and said, hey, this is great, he said, we can't go on that assumption. Let's go on and try to make it better. And I think that sort of notion of staying hungry and not listening to the good news is what keeps him going. When he sits and shows the rough cuts of his films to the dozen or so people whom he trusts in New York, he's not interested in people saying, gee, this is really wonderful. What he wants to hear as critically as possible is what doesn't work and why. It doesn't mean that he'll then say, oh, yes, and then go off and change it. Because sometimes he'll say people make these criticisms, and, you know, it's nice that they make it, but they're absolutely wrong. But sometimes he'll catch something, he'll say, yes, that's right. And it's the negative stuff that he wants to hear.
So he's not a snob.
No, and as he says, there are critics who attack me all the time, and he says, you know, the truth is, I'm in many ways closer to their feeling about me than I am about the people who praise me so much of the time. And it's not meant as a slight to those people, but it's a sense of saying, you know, I know that I still haven't made the perfect movie. It's again his compulsion here, and he wants very, very much to make movies that will really stand the test of time, that will be like Grand Illusion, as one he points out, or The Bicycle Thief. He says, I've made, you know, 20 movies. Many of them are quite good, but I don't have those little shining points of light that in a director's career really, really make them shine, that really raise them to the highest level. And he says, I hope that now that I'm in my 50s and I'm a father and I see life a little differently, that, you know, maybe now I'll be capable of doing that.
Well, thank you, Eric Lax, for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. This is a great pleasure.
Eric Lax's book is about Woody Allen, and it's called Woody Allen. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. We'll be having news today of Secretary Baker's return to Washington and what he and President Bush have to say. They managed to sound optimistic about what the Secretary of State has achieved on his trip to Israel and the Arab states. We'll also have news today of what financial cuts are likely to mean for the city of New York, for people who live there and work there. Talk with New York City journalist Jack Newfield about how the political hassles over cutting the budget might end up. One Colorado town's distress over junk bond financing that went wrong, and a defense of junk bonds by Nobel laureate in economics Harry Markowitz.
Okay. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later on All Things Considered. Henry Jaglom is like a one-man film studio. He writes, directs, produces, casts, and even distributes all his own movies. Movies like Can She Bake a Cherry Pie, Someone to Love, and New Year's Day. Stephen Schiff has a review of Jaglom's new movie, Eating.
There's a strange condescension in Henry Jaglom's love of women. Look at them, he seems to say. They're so beautiful, so seductive, so smart and funny and sage. And yet the poor, deluded little creatures are doomed to eternal triviality because all they want to talk or think about is food. Well, he has a point. Women are more obsessed with food and its effects than men. And yes, guys, it's largely our fault. But having hit upon that not-too-subtle truth, Jaglom doesn't have the slightest idea what to do with it. In Eating, he gathers dozens of trendy-looking women, most of them white, attractive, well-to-do actresses, and sets them up in a house for an all-day, all-female birthday party. The dialogue is largely improvised, and Jaglom tries to distract you from how boring most of it is by whip-cutting between one speaker and another, breaking up the talk so that some of it sounds pithy and catchy and epigrammatic. There's almost no plot, and what there is stunningly unconvincing, but every now and then one of the women hits on something juicy.
I mean, this is like Mozart.
That's a lot of carbohydrate. Mozart.
Yeah, I think food is like music. You know, Beethoven is beef. Stravinsky salad, you know, mixed salad with pickles. Vivaldi's fruit salad, a bowl of fruit.
What's that? That's Tchaikovsky. That's tragic.
That's amusing enough, but unfortunately it stands high on Jaglom's list of insights. His movie pretends to a universality it doesn't have. His women are overwhelmingly obsessive and overwhelmingly Southern Californian. They're caricatures posing as documentary subjects. Jaglom's camera almost quivers with pleasure whenever they sound really neurotic. For him, neurosis is truth, and you sometimes have the appalling feeling that his characters, I almost said patients, are confessing to twisted feelings they don't even have just because it seems to give their director so much pleasure. Still, no matter how much these people define and redefine what food means to them, they never get below the surface. The cult of the body in this culture has made food seem a forbidden pleasure to these women, like a drug. Eating is their vice, their high, their addiction. And like any addictive substance, food drives a hard bargain. It offers comfort, but you pay in self-destruction. Eventually, you can glean all that from this movie, but it's unnecessarily hard work, because Jaglom has done nothing to direct all the talk or push it further. The women say things like, "The safest sex you can have is eating," or "I have trouble eating with somebody I like," or "Food is the only thing I can count on for unconditional love." But after a while, it all sounds hopelessly redundant. Jaglom doesn't know how to dramatize anything. His bulimics are bulimic for the sake of discussion. His jilted wives are jilted so they can turn to eating, and then we can hear more talk about that. It's such a waste. Jaglom has touched upon a fascinating subject and assembled an appealing cast. And then, instead of making a movie, he stages a seminar.
Film critic Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. The show was produced this week by Fred Landerl. The engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Richard Parker. Terry will be back next time. I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Martin Duberman is a historian and gay rights activist. But before the days of the gay liberation movement, Duberman went to psychiatrists seeking a cure for his homosexuality. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about his new memoir, Cures. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.